Okay, so welcome to today's podcast. I'm absolutely delighted to have Professor Thomas Hyland Erickson, one of the 16 key thinkers from the New Politics and Society course, as my guest today. So welcome to the podcast, Professor Erickson.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's by the wonders of technology that we're having this conversation today. So you're obviously in Oslo at the moment, and I'm here in my home in Lucan in West Dublin. So yeah, it's brilliant that we're able to do this.
Yes.
So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to give a little bit of background about, I guess, yourself and your academic work, and then we'll kind of get into discussing that, if that's okay.
Yes.
So, Professor Erickson, you are a Norwegian anthropologist. You are the Professor of Anthropology at the University of Oslo, and you are the President of the European Association of Social Anthropologists. You are also a member of the Norwegian Academy of Science and Letters, and you've also been a political candidate for various Norwegian political parties. Your work has taken you all over the world, from Trinidad to Mauritius to the Seychelles and Australia. And I guess the areas of work that you primarily focus in are identity, nationalism, globalization, identity politics, ethnicity, climate change, migration, and human rights. So it's really broad.
Yes, but to me, all of these topics are interconnected, because they say something about the, you might say, the challenges and the difficulties and the opportunities that we experience when we live in the contemporary world.
Very good. So I think possibly, you know, when I'm speaking to all of the people who have taken part, who have been chosen by the NCCA to be key thinkers, I'm like, this person has been chosen specifically to represent this field. And I think it's fair to say that you are the guy who has spent a lot of your career popularizing this particular field. So you're one of the forerunners of the field of social anthropology. Your work is concerned with three things. It's understanding the present world, understanding what it means to be human, and then you've tried to help to bring social and environmental change. So yes. Do you consider yourself an activist as well as an academic?
Yes, definitely. I think these things very often go together, and that we distinguish far too easily between those two things, because I think all good research has a strong existential dimension. There is something which is at stake for you, something which is important. It could be driven just by curiosity. I mean, that's something I really need to find out, you know, in math or physics or whatever. Or it could be fueled by some kind of human engagement, because you see all the injustices around you. As a young man, I was absolutely shocked, you know, to discover the extent of poverty and the extent of oppression around the world, and the extent to which many people are not really being heard at all. The majority of people in the world are not really being heard, because we white people from the north speak on their behalf. So this is one of the things that attracted me to anthropology. But let me say a little bit more about why I became an anthropologist and not something else. Why not a sociologist? Why not a philosopher or something else? Yes, it's driven by curiosity, and that's part of it. You know, the wish to understand what it is to be a human being under the most diverse of circumstances. You know, anthropologists, we go up into the highlands of New Guinea, we study stockbrokers in Manhattan, or we study housewives in Bergen in Western Norway, all of these people are quite different from each other in many ways. And at the end of the day, we are still all human. So what is it that makes us human? What is it that we all have in common? So that's the, what is it to be a human being? And to me, this is a much more fascinating approach, personally, than the one you get through philosophy, where people basically just discuss with other academics or with other philosophers, because we go out there and try to learn from other people about their lives in a very serious way. That's part of it. But the other reason that I chose anthropology is that it was the only science or the only discipline at my university which did not have Europe, as it were, as its main focus. What anthropology taught me at a very early age when I started my undergrad studies was that all human lives are equally interesting, no matter where people live, and they're equally important, no matter where they live. To me, that was a very sort of democratic and a very humanistic, you might say, approach to the world. And thirdly, and a third thing about anthropology was that you know, whenever you entered the common room or the tea room at our department, there was always someone there who had just returned from the field, who had stories to tell, you know, about strange things that had happened, people they'd met, you know, puzzles that they hadn't really been able to solve about how other people looked at the world. So to me, it's a never-ending quest to understand the world. And when you've sort of understood it, at least partly, you try to change it a bit. You try to improve a few things.
So, yeah, that's really, really interesting, because maybe some people feel that, like, why would I go to Bergen in Norway and look at the lives of ordinary people, like, for example, a group of housewives or whatever. So in that particular study, what would the study have consisted of, and what would you have been bringing back into the field then when you're back in the common room in your university speaking about it? What change were you trying to observe, or what difference, or what were you trying to observe, and what were you trying to do as a result of that particular field study?
Yeah, good question. You know, when I before I went on my first fieldwork, which was in Mauritius in the Indian Ocean, which is a place to which I still feel very attached. I mean, I keep going back there as often as I can, and I'm in touch with people. They're both academics and other Mauritians. So what my supervisor said before I left was, try to find out what it is that makes people tick. What is it that's at stake for them? What's important for them? And it turns out that around the world, it does not take you very long to find out what is really at stake for people. And it tends to be many of the same things. What happens when I die? Am I going to have a family if you're a young person? You worry about your children, you worry about love, and you worry about your material security. You know, will I have anything to eat tomorrow? That sort of thing. So there are many similarities that we can bring back. But then there are also all these little differences. Why is it, you know, that, for example, in a suburb in Bergen, in Western Norway, when someone has a coffee party and other housewives are brought in, excuse me, why is it that whenever the hostess leaves the room and goes into the kitchen, they immediately sort of they try to scratch the surface of the tables, and they check whether the flowers have been bought it, and they do all of these sort of little moral exercises. And this tells us something about this community of housewives being a moral community. You're a good housewife if you dust regularly, and if you water your flowers and so on, and you're a slovenly and bad housewife if you don't. So in other words, it tells us something about morality, but it can also tell you a lot about other things. What do they gossip about? People gossip about other people. And how do they gossip? And how do they see themselves in relation to others? Are they better or worse? In this particular study, working class women in Bergen in Western Norway, turned out that people looked very much down upon students. You know, students were almost like homeless people to them, because they didn't make a living, they were not financially independent, and they dressed in a very sort of rough and informal way. But they also had a very condescending view towards people who were above them on the social ladder, people who were very rich, because they were snobs and they didn't understand the lives of ordinary people. So they saw themselves, as most people in the world do, as solid, ordinary, average people. So in other words, we try to make our way, to meander our way through all these differences between the cultures of the world in order to discover something that we have in common.
So it's about, so being an anthropologist is about finding things out in common, because, sorry, I'm just thinking, like, you know, like, I can see the use, I'm just thinking about on behalf of other people, I suppose, as well, looking at a group of prisoners, for example, and trying to find out how did these people get themselves into this situation that is now a social problem as such, you know?
Yeah.
And so looking at that, there's a benefit for broader society, you know, if we can understand this, maybe we can stop it somehow, or stop people having to exist this life, have this existence, you know? But what is the use then, your job, in terms of looking at a group of ordinary people that are not creating a social problem as such, they're just living their ordinary lives. Where does the line get drawn between being nosy and being providing useful information? Because people might be wondering that, in terms of, I mean, I'd love to, we all love, I suppose, we watch soap operas because we love to look at the lives of other people. We watch we'll watch reality television because we want to know what the Kardashians, what people who lead lives of luxury, what their lives are like and what makes them tick. But how is it useful? How is that useful then? Is it that commonality you're talking about?
Thank you. Great question. But if I could just return very briefly to your first example of people who are in prison, who have committed offences. Very often in our societies, we look at symptoms and we try just to remove the symptoms instead of looking at the underlying causes. Understanding the underlying causes takes longer and it's harder to do something about, but it's more enduring than just scratching the surface and removing the symptoms. But to return to your real question, what's the value of studying, as it were, ordinary, average people who are not causing social problems? Well, one is identification. You know, one of the things that anthropology has taught me is that it could have been me, you know? Mm-hmm. It could have been me. Can we take a break? Half a minute. There's a noise here.
Absolutely, yep.
So why is it interesting? Why is it interesting to look at ordinary people? What's so fascinating about ordinary people? Well, I mean, take a good novel. You know, good novels are often about ordinary people, and they are described in such a way that as a reader you identify with them, and you realize that it could have been me, you know? I might have done the same thing in that situation.
Yeah, we have a saying in Ireland, I don't know if you ever heard it, there go I, but for the grace of God. You know, like, this path could have been me. And it's a great way to look at your life, really, because it gives you an empathy, I suppose, for other people.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the civilizing missions of anthropology, is to create that empathy and to make it as universal as possible so that you can identify with people who otherwise lead very different lives to yourselves. And you realize that under those circumstances, had I grown up in this society, had I grown up in an Afghan village, I would have behaved like this and, you know, not the way I do. And it would have come across to me as perfectly normal. So everything could have been different here as well. That's another thing that we learn from anthropology. Because we human beings are born with the possibility of living thousands of different lives. And then we end up living just one. And by reading about other cultures and by identifying with other people who live in very different kinds of societies, in African villages, in Chinese cities and so on, you can almost live those lives vicariously.
Yeah. And I guess by social media and globalization has made that confusing somewhat? Do you think that we're kind of changing our identities then, you know, based on this globalization that you kind of, a lot of your work is focused on?
Yes, a lot has changed. In some ways, globalization brings us closer to each other because we know more, or we think we know more about each other. But paradoxically, it can also tear us apart because we learn more about our mutual differences. Sorry.
Can we?
I'm so sorry. I'll return to you.
Okay.
So in other words, the more you learn about other people's lives, the easier it is to identify with them and to empathize with their situation. So there is a lot of ignorance and a lot of superficial knowledge around. And through globalization, we often get the feeling that we're all one big human family because we consume the same things. We go to McDonald's, we watch some of the same American films, we dress more and more similarly. You know, you can go to the interior of the Amazon forest and you find people in Manchester United T-shirts, that sort of thing. But as you and I know, these similarities can be quite superficial. And that's another thing about globalization, is that you could say that owing to the forces of globalization, we become more similar in certain ways when it comes to consumption, so dreams and that kind of thing, mobile phones, technology, whatever. But the more similar we become, the more different we try to be. And that's part of the reason why identity and the politics of identity have become so powerful in the last few decades. The yearning to be different, to be unique, to be yourself, not just to be a product of the market or a product of globalization. But the second paradox is that in some ways, you could say that the more different we try to be, the more similar we become, because people around the world try to be different in many of the same ways. Yes. You look across the fence and you see that, well, those people, they've got their own folk music. We've got our folk music. They've got folk dress. We need to have folk dress. I first came across this paradox when I was looking at the indigenous population of the far north of Scandinavia, the Sami, people who were formerly known as the Lapps. Many of them are reindeer herders. Many of them live ordinary lives. Of course, they live in cities and so on, but they have a strong cultural and social identity. And the Sami ethno-political movement, the Sami movement, which sort of tried to promote rights to land and water and language and so on, it looked almost like a replica of Norwegian nationalism. You know, they had the same dress, you know, or similar, you know, everything was comparable. So that's another paradox of globalization.
So Norway is a very interesting country, really, in a lot of ways, in terms of how it is changing. In a lot of ways, similar to Ireland, I guess, you know, that we're this tiny little island and we had a very specific demographic for so long. And I guess over the last few decades, particularly with economic change, brought other forms of change. We had people coming from Eastern Europe to work because we had a shortage of workers. We have people coming from all over the world to reside in Ireland now. And I'm interested in one particular piece of research that you did, which was an interdisciplinary research program called Cultural Complexity in the New Norway.
That's right.
Yeah, so it was COLCOM for short. It was a large-scale research project that you were investigating. And what I really like is the aim of that project was that you were trying to redraw the map of Norway to make it fit this new transnational complex and globalized realities. So you were trying to assess, I suppose, where Norway was at and how you can help to forge a new map that would help to facilitate it and its society in kind of embracing, I suppose, what was happening. So could you tell us a little bit about that and the, I suppose, the context of why you needed to do that project?
I'd love to do that. As a matter of fact, I think, you know, what we did in Norway, I mean, it could just as well have been done in Ireland or in the Netherlands or in many European and even non-European countries, because we've all gone through some of the same changes. In a not too distant past, having a nation, to many of us, certainly in Ireland and Norway, which, as you said, you know, fairly homogeneous and so on, and with a clear sense of history and where we're coming from, the nation equaled the state, equaled the territory, equaled the people, equaled the religion, equaled the language, equaled an ethnic group, and that was it. And all of a sudden, things turned out to be more complicated. And it also turned out that things had been more complicated in the past. There was a lot of cultural complexity in the old Norway as well, only we never learned about that at school. There were minorities, there were Jews, there were travelers, there were various kinds of minority language-speaking people who... minority language-speaking people who were simply not recognized, who were not visible in the official narratives. But, of course, what's happened in the last few decades, as you suggest, is fairly dramatic in some countries. You know, in my country, which has had a booming economy, so it's attracted lots of immigrants of all kinds. I mean, refugees, labor migrants, and so on. The proportion of minorities or immigrants in the population has gone from about 5% 25 years ago to 13% now, which is significant. And in a city like Oslo, it's more than 30% with a minority background. So the question is then, who are we? What does it entail to be we Norwegians? What does it take to be Norwegian? Do you have to be white? Do you have to be Christian? Do your ancestors have to come from Norway? Or is it enough that you live there and pay your taxes and send your children to school and learn the language? You know, these kinds of debates, we're having them all over Europe. What are the limits of the nation? What are the boundaries? And interestingly enough, you know, in classic political anthropology, which was about tribal societies in East Africa, there were two ways of thinking about who you were as part of a larger entity, political entity. Either it was kinship, you know, we belong to the same group because we have the same ancestors, or it was place. We belong to the same group because we live in the same village. And these two principles often came into conflict with each other, because you would have people living in the same village who had different ancestors, right? And this is where we're at in the debates about national identities in Europe today. So what we did in COCOM, in the cultural complexity, was that we went out. I mean, we had master's students, PhD students, and researchers in various disciplines, from theology to politics to history and anthropology, who were trying to find out the ways in which, you might say, the Norwegian society and culture was able to accommodate diversity. To what? How diverse can we be and still have a sense of a collective self, being us, etc.? Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's no simple answer to this, but my short answer is as follows. Okay, my short conclusion. I mean, I've been looking into this in many societies, in Mauritius as well. That's where I started looking at nationalism and ethnic diversity. The short answer is that a society can perfectly well live with a great deal of cultural diversity. And by that, I also mean religious diversity, as long as you have functioning social institutions. In other words, you have a labor market, which works for everyone. You have a state bureaucracy, in our case, a welfare state, which works for everyone, which you can trust. And the trust is mutual, so that you trust the state, the state trusts you, that sort of thing. As long as you have these functioning institutions, you have a school which doesn't discriminate on the basis of ethnicity, religion, race, etc. As long as these things are in place, you can have quite a bit of cultural diversity without it sort of disrupting the fabric of society. And this is why it is so disquieting these days that so many of the debates about majorities and minorities in European countries nowadays are about Islam, about religion, and not about how do people belong. You know, jobs, I mean, education, security, that sort of thing.
So the focus often in discussion from the top, the people in government to people on the street, is maybe focused on the wrong area. So instead of focusing on who belongs and who is entitled to a place within our society, it should be looking at the way in which institutions and the organs of the state provide to let people feel like they belong. Because if it came from, if we looked at that direction a little bit better, it might solve the problem.
I think you're perfectly right. If you look at the ways in which young people from European cities were recruited to ISIS, for example, to fight, you know, for this horrible terrorist organization in the Middle East, turns out that, you know, many of them felt that they didn't belong. They wanted to be someone. They wanted to be seen. They wanted recognition and so on. Of course, they were looking for the wrong kind of recognition, but it was understandable because they felt that they lived in a society which would never accept them as fully fledged card-carrying members because they had the wrong skin color or the wrong religion or both.
Yes, yes. And then, was it a part of that project where you looked at the attack that happened in 2011 by the perpetrator was Anders Behring Breivik? Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that particular episode and how it impacted your work as such?
Yes. In fact, the COCOM project was completed at the time of the terrorist attack. But the terrorist, Breivik, he had an obsession with us, you see. So he quotes me something like 15 times in his manifesto as a symbol of everything that's gone wrong with Norway, because I had been promoting diversity as something potentially positive, at least something we have to live with. I mean, if you don't like diversity, find yourself a different century. You know, you can't live in the 21st century and not accept some degree of diversity. So we were seen as the enemy, as traitors to the idea of the nation. Mm. Whereas probably many of our researchers, they saw themselves rather as representatives of a new vision of the nation, a nation which was more inclusive, a nation which could accommodate difference, where being members of the same community was not necessarily a result of being the same. It was not necessarily a result of sameness or similarity. You could perfectly well think about yourself as being a member of a community with people who are quite different from yourself because you perform different tasks. and we have different specialties and so on. So here we have two very different ideas about the nation. One of them, you might say, is anchored to some extent in German Romanticism, it's about kinship and about culture and about the past and about your obligations, as it were, to tradition and so on. Whereas the other idea of the nation is more focused on the present, on the future, on the individual, on choice, etc. And on mixing as something potentially good.
Yes, yes.
You know, I mean, cultural mixing. I mean, where would we be if it hadn't been for the African slaves in North America? There would have been no popular music. There would have been no rock and roll.
There would have been no jazz. There would have been so much.
There would have been no Thin Lizzy.
Yeah, no Thin Lizzy. That's right. Are you a Thin Lizzy fan?
Yeah, I used to be, at the time. Yeah.
I watched Questions and Answers with Spike Lee, the African-American film director, recently, and he said the exact same thing as you. You know, just that the way that the landscape, the social landscape and the ethnic landscape of America, the way it looks today, and how that the culture relies so heavily on African Americans being there, and then the disparity in terms of how a lot of African Americans feel within that society in terms of belonging, especially with what, like, it was actually the Questions and Answers was around a recent film which he has made called The Black Klansman, which was based on a true story where an African American man infiltrated the Ku Klux Klan. But the end part of the film was kind of looking at recent events of Charlottesville and how that racism still persists within that society. But sorry, just to kind of
get very deeply entrenched. Absolutely. If I could just add something to this, is that okay?
Yes, absolutely.
I think it's crucial and it's important, and we shouldn't deny the fact that racism exists. Probably in every European society, probably to a greater extent than we're sometimes willing to admit. But one thing is changing your attitudes, being tolerant, being taught tolerance and so on, which is fine, you know. Respect the other, you know, I'm a Muslim, but I respect the Jews because they come from the same sort of general tradition as I do. I respect the Hindus because they also have an idea of the spiritual and so on. You can perfectly well have a tolerant, multiculturalist society, which is also very unjust at the level of economics and distribution. If you take a country like Mauritius, where I've been working, the Creoles, who are the people of African descent in Mauritius, a bit like the African Americans in the United States, they were plantation slaves, I mean, in the 19th century. And they are being lifted up as the symbols of Mauritian culture. You know, their music, their dance, their food, and so on. This is a Creole society. We like having fun, drinking rum on the beach, and that sort of thing. So they're being marketed as a symbol of Mauritius towards tourists and foreigners. Whereas at the same time, the Creoles as an ethnic group remain just as downtrodden as they always were.
Nice.
So it doesn't always help. So I've been thinking about this in relation to Israel, the West Bank, Israel-Palestine, that situation. Yes, you can teach Palestinians to be tolerant. Of course, they don't mind Jews. What they do mind is people stealing the land.
Mm-mm.
Which is something very different. And tolerance doesn't help when someone is stealing your land.
Yes, yes.
So we have to be careful, you know, to make these distinctions.
Yes, I suppose similar to Northern Ireland, I suppose, how do people live on a day-to-day basis? I'm not talking about currently, but particularly in the height of the Troubles in the 1970s, you know, there can be real impacts on a day-to-day basis of you know, the social setup, the political setup, the economic setup. And you're right, I think it really boils down to economics a lot of the time. So when people's lives are being impacted by their ability to move freely, to live a quality, to have any kind of quality of life, then their ability to tolerate is changed, you know.
Yes.
I
agree. And another related issue with which I've been working quite a bit in the last few years is to do with not economics as such, but I would say, you know, resources in general. And one resource is recognition, the recognition of others, the feeling of being taken seriously and being listened to. And that's also one of the civilizing, as you know, missions of anthropology, is that we really do our best, you know, to take ordinary people, average people, seriously, and to listen, to hear them out, as it were.
So just recently in Ireland, the travelling community, which are an Indigenous community here in Ireland, have just recently received their recognition from the state as being an ethnic minority in their own right, something that they really had to fight for a very, very long time. And I guess probably for people who aren't members of that community, they might say, well, why is that important to you? Why is that a thing? But it's very hard when you're experiencing the privileges of day-to-day life and everything that goes with just that normalcy of being accepted as such,
yes,
to understand, to be empathetic towards somebody who is fighting very, very difficult battle against the state and against other members of their society, to be seen as, to be recognised as, and to get the appropriate recognition that they deserve then from the state. So, yes.
It's very important. And in fact, over here, I mean, I've been working a bit with travelling communities here, which have a very similar history to the travellers in Ireland. And what they, all of them, tell you, without exception, is that when they grew up, it was shameful, you know, to be a traveller. You had to try to conceal it from others because you were considered, you know, filthy, lazy, criminal, etc. And you had no culture and you had nothing to be proud of. So being told that your past and whatever you were taught by your parents is worthless, and whatever your tradition is it's just something that should be obliterated and forgotten. Become like us. Be like us and be grateful for it. That's a colonizing attitude which has led to a lot of humiliation around the world.
Yeah, but it also deprives the wider society of fantastic pockets of culture which contribute to a healthy and a diverse and a more interesting cultural landscape. If we obliterated the entire traditional Irish music scene, for example, in Ireland, imagine all of that culture that would be drawn out of our wider society. If we took away our entire history related to Irish dance, we said, oh, that's worthless and no good. Yes. Well, imagine how devastating that would be to the wider, you know. But sorry, I just want to return. Oh, sorry, go on, Hendon.
In terms not only of the sort of the cultural wealth of the world, that you would somehow you would lose some of the ingredients, but also in terms of self-esteem. Right, because all of a sudden you're being told that whatever you did in the past or whatever your parents did in the past has no value. You can imagine how that feels. And that's a feeling that indigenous peoples around the world have become accustomed to for centuries, because they've been told by us, basically, that they should become like us. Otherwise, they're not going anywhere.
Yes.
And I sometimes compare, because anthropology is the study of human diversity in many ways, the kind of cultural diversity that we have in the world with biological diversity, you know, biodiversity, that you have this enormous range of species and subspecies and so on. And much of it is now going away because of the industrialization of agriculture, oil palm plantations, and various forms of infrastructural development. And similarly, a lot of the cultural wealth that we have in the world is being threatened. Yes. Languages are dying out, customs are being forgotten, and so on. And as humanity, we all lose from this. So that's one of the big dangers of globalization.
And actually, that kind of brings us nicely into looking at probably one of your latest pieces of work, Overheating.
Yes.
So the book kind of focuses on five specific areas: energy, waste, cities, mobility, and information.
Yeah.
And you're arguing that this accelerated and intense pace of globalization has led to three main problems. So cultural identity, which you've spoken about, the economy, and then the physical environment. So can we talk a little bit about that maybe, and why you focused on that? And
absolutely. So to me, overheating is really, it's a metaphor. It's not just about, or even mainly about, climate change. It's about acceleration. Because, you know, if you rub your hands together, they warm up, right? And if you could rub your hands together really, really fast, they would eventually burn up. But you can't do that because you have an inbuilt thermostat in your body, which tells you that it's fine now, you're warm enough. Stop, you know. Whereas the kind of global overheating that we're seeing in the worlds of the economy, where things are really moving so fast, it's almost impossible to understand, in the realm of environmental destruction, which we know quite a bit about. I mean, they say now that within 2050, there's going to be more plastic than fish in the sea. Mm-hmm. And also with identities, the frictions between identities that come into conflict with each other, because they're being threatened by outside, by these fast changes. That these process is to not have a thermostat. There's no instance that can say, enough is enough, let's cool down, let's do things a bit more slowly, because nobody knows where this is going to end. So that's part of the framework for overheating. So what we were looking at in this research project, which was officially completed last year, but of course books are still coming out. I mean, my own book from Australia just came out a couple of weeks ago, called Boomtown, about a city which has grown really quickly in on the Queensland coast in Australia. So publications are still coming out from this project. But what we were doing was that we went around the world. I mean, one of our scholars, she went to Peru, to Highland Peru, and she was looking at water and water shortages. Another went to Alberta, Canada, to look at the tar sand industry and how it articulated with, or how it related to, the indigenous population in Canada. And I went to Australia to look at the dilemmas of fossil fuels in on the very picturesque and beautiful Queensland coast, where there's also a lot of coal and gas. So what we were interested in was local people's responses to these accelerated changes, which are washing over you from outside in many cases. They're just coming. I mean, like one of the guys in Sierra Leone said, in West Africa, to my PhD student who was working there, from one day to the next, the jungle on the other side of the little river was gone. There'd been jungle there all this time. All of a sudden, there was no longer any jungle. But there was a biofuel plantation. And the people who were working there, they were not African, and they weren't European, but they were Chinese. And there was a fence around it. And then the anthropologist asked him, "So, what's going on here? I mean, this wasn't here when I last visited." And the guy shrugs and says, "Well, you know, man, it's the global." So it's a sense, it's a way of expressing powerlessness. It's a global. It's something that just washes over you, and there's nothing you can do about it, which is a very dangerous situation.
So people, when people feel a lack of control, they feel insecure, I suppose. And insecurity is a big problem. It's a fear. When a fear develops, then people's behaviour can start to act as a consequence of that, I suppose. And it can be very dangerous.
It can be very dangerous in many ways. I mean, one thing is that insecurity can often breed hatred and anger and aggression and so on. But it's also dangerous in the sense that people lose faith in their democratic institutions, in democratic societies. So what I saw in Australia was that increasingly people felt that they couldn't trust the politicians anymore, because the politicians were in cahoots with the big corporations. And it was really all about following the money. It was not about following the truth, which is a fairly dangerous thing. And the little man and woman have that growing feeling that nobody cares about me, nobody cares about my views, you know. I can do whatever I like and they're not going to take notice.
Is it fair to say that trust is almost like the foundation of the state?
Yes.
That if it's like a house, and that if there isn't a strong foundation stone of trust underneath, that everything else is unstable above it. Everything else can crumble. Society can crumble. We can have more crime. We'll have more all different kinds of social problems if there isn't that level of trust. And not just crime on a street level, I suppose. Crime in terms of fraud at a much higher up level as well. Kind of dishonest behaviour. If we take out the trust, if nobody feels that they can trust each other on any level within society, then it's a free-for-all, really. It's a kind of a every man for himself society.
Yes, and it also, that sort of, the loss of trust also breeds cynicism. So people, there's a real risk that people lose the belief that they can make a difference. They lose faith in their own ability to making a difference for the better, because someone else is taking the decisions anyway, and whatever I do is not going to matter. That feeling is very strong, and it creates a kind of resentment that has partly led to the rise of right-wing populism in Europe, where people feel that the distance between themselves and the politicians is growing, and the politicians increasingly don't really see the ordinary man and woman, and don't really care, and they don't care to go there. So some of the recent developments in Europe and in North America, I mean, with the election of Donald Trump as president, can be understood partly on this background, the feeling that the elites are far too far away from my little world for them to care about me at all. So why should I care about them, and why should I trust them?
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to Brexit in the UK, I mean, to a great extent, I think many of the complaints that people had who voted Leave were correct. People at Westminster didn't really care about them, mm-hmm. about people who were unemployed in the third generation in Doncaster, you know, that sort of, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. They didn't really. I mean, they hadn't done anything for them. And the United States, I mean, Hillary Clinton didn't even go and visit some of those old mining communities where unemployment rates were like 35% and there were big social problems and so on. Didn't even bother to visit. So the sense that the elites are treating us with condescending arrogance and that the gap is widening between us and them is in fact quite dangerous for the future of democracy.
It has genuine and real impact. I have to say, one of the things that I like most about your work is this idea of powerful people, you know, who are in control, whether they're politicians or academics like ourselves, that there seems to be this lack of going out and understanding them on it. Obviously, this is what your work does. You do go out and you try to understand people at your own level. But this is one of the things that you've focused on in your work, is trying to reveal the lack of ability of people in power to actually go out and talk to people on a base level, find out what people's lives are like, try to understand that. Because the reality is, and studies have shown, that if politicians and people in power, whether they're financial power or political power or social power, go out and meet with people on the ground, that it genuinely actually has a huge influence on the choices that they make in their position of power.
Mm. It does, but it requires an effort, and it requires that you try somehow to close at least the gap, close the gap partly, because that's also an effect of globalization. You know that the distance between the people are being, whose fate is being decided by others, and the people who take the decisions is growing, owing to amalgamations, to corporations growing larger and larger and larger, so that. To take an example from Australia, just to illustrate my point, there was a conflict between a small mine where I was working, a small limestone mine, and some farmers, because the mine was pumping out water, and they complained that the groundwater was being depleted, and it was being, the quality of the water deteriorated, and they wanted compensation. Only 20 years ago, these farmers, they could go to the managing director, who was a local bloke, you know, he lived in the town next door, and say, look, Mr. Smith, I mean, you're pumping out our groundwater. We want compensation. And he knows you. So he would say, oh, yeah, yeah, Mr. Jones, I'll put down your name and phone number here, and I'll ring you back next week. And he actually would, because he was part of the same community. Whereas nowadays, 20 years on, you walk into the same office with the same complaint, and the guy behind the desk, he's not a local at all. He's not even Australian. I mean, he's someone who was hired by this now amalgamated, enormous cement company called Cement Australia, one of the largest cement companies in the world. And he would say, I'm really sorry, Mr. Jones, I can't help you with your problem, but send an email to our main office. Good luck, you know, you see?
Yes, pointless.
So there's lack of accountability by moving things up the scale. Mm-hmm. Very dangerous, because it creates resentment and as you say, it reduces trust and faith in the system.
Mm-mm. I'm very conscious of your time and we'll finish up. But before we do that, can I just ask, kind of in a tangent to your academic work, like the practicalities of your job? I mean, you received your doctorate in 1991, I think.
Yeah,
and you were made a full professor in 1995. So 4 years later, at the age of 33, you were made a full professor. And ever since then, and most likely before then as well, you've been this public figure. You've been out there on various media, television, writing articles in newspapers constantly and putting your ideas out there. And, I mean, even this incident with Anders Breivik, you know, I mean, that's a scary position to be in a lot of the time. You know, and I think, like I say, for me, I'm doing my PhD at the moment, and it can be frightening putting any idea out there into the public arena, because not just are people going to kind of take down your idea and nitpick it apart and criticise you, you feel self-conscious, you know, when you're putting an opinion or an idea out there. And I'm just thinking about our audience who are listening in today, and, you know, it takes a lot of courage, I guess, to put your opinions and your ideas and thoughts out there. And there can be very real consequences. I mean, a terrorist, a man who did some very, very serious damage within your country, is focused on you and singled you out as somebody who he really did not like. How do you deal with that? I'm talking on even a very, very basic level. Just how do you deal with that?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not, as it were, sort of paranoid or worried. I mean, it's not one of my sort of personality traits. I tend not to worry. And after the terrorist attack, when there were rumors that there were other people like himself, you know, around, that in fact he had a network, there were people who were suggesting to me that maybe I should ask for police protection. But that would not help. You know, you can't have police following you around. You can't have a police car, you know, outside your house at night. It would have been untenable. So you just go on and live your life as you always would. But you should encourage others to come forward and take a position. And some of the people I admire the most in our societies these days are minority women, you know, who come out and either they speak unpopular truths to their own community about patriarchy, about enforced marriages and so on, or they speak uncomfortable truths to the majority about racism and exclusion and so on, or maybe they do both. And many of them live constantly in fear, under threat, and yet they feel that it's their moral duty to do so. Mm-hmm. So my conviction is that if something important is at stake, you shouldn't think too much about your personal security. I sometimes think that there are certain historical periods that make us larger than we are, such as the Second World War. It did in many cases, because it was a war against pure evil, in a sense. And people put their own lives at risk. Ordinary people put their own lives at risk in order to fight this evil force. And other historical periods make us smaller than we are. So we end up just watching our little screens and cocooning ourselves into a world of, a kind of addictive media consumption. And it's not healthy, you know, in a world where there are so many unresolved challenges, anything to do with the environment, to racism and to inequality. Yes. So I think we have a moral duty, all of us as citizens.
So usually I like to finish up the podcast by asking the academic to give a little bit of advice to any kind of budding anthropologists out there, people who might be interested in society and politics and economics. So would that be your advice, to be brave, to challenge what's out there, or any advice you have to offer would be fantastic?
Yes, and to follow your heart. Never forget that being an academic, certainly being an anthropologist or in a related discipline, is not mainly about being clever and about showing people how much you know, but it's also about engaging directly with the world and putting yourself, you know, as it were, at the forefront. I mean, it's about your own life. It's not just about getting a job. As I told people when I was last in Mauritius, I gave a lecture at the university there. I said that, you know, I mean, Mauritius didn't just help with my academic career. It changed my life.
Yes. So it was enriching for you as well.
Yeah, because it taught me about the diversity and about living together and about compassion and about a number of things and about appreciating the small things in life. You know, I lived in a small, poor fishing village. People were quite happy.
Yes.
You know, because they had learned to appreciate the little pleasures.
Yes.
So yes. So
and that's taught you that you should also try to enjoy those little pleasures of life as well.
Yeah, I do indeed. Thank you.
That is fantastic. Yeah. Listen, we will leave it at that. Professor Thomas Hyland Erickson, you have been an absolute gentleman, and it has been a pleasure to speak with you on the podcast today.
Real pleasure. Thanks so much for inviting me.